This is the Education Gadfly Show.
But not enough to cancel.
A rain day? Really?
We had a fog day once, I'm just saying.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming our very special guest for this week, the Nick Foles of Education Reform, Connor Williams. Welcome, Connor.
It's good to be here. So, Foles, I'm what, the backup or the backup to the backup?
I wouldn't put it that way. You're the MVP, baby. You're the MVP. Also joining us, our other MVP, Alyssa Schwenk.
Fly, Eagles, fly.
Go, Eagles. So, hey, Connor is a senior researcher at New America with expertise in education policy and practices related to educational equity, dual language learners, immigration, and school choice. He is Education Reform's English language learners guy, the one and only. Great to have you on the show, Connor.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We were talking beforehand that as a dad, you have given up on your football addiction, which I totally respect. And as I've mentioned, I think before on the show, I'm hoping that my 10-year-old son loses interest in football before he gets anywhere near tackle football in high school, or that the high school gets rid of tackle football before we get there, which I think would make my life a lot easier.
May I just plug competitive swimming, lowest injury rate of any high school sport.
Yeah. Hey, he's doing that too.
Specifically this discussion yesterday. My son was asking me about what sports could you play and how cool all these sports. And I said, well, we're ranking. Like basketball, you can get elbowed in the nose and that's not good, but compared to football, it's much better. And we ended up at swimming, right? You can't hurt your head unless you run into the wall. I mean, you're so safe. Yeah.
I will say I broke two toes and sprained a knee on the pool deck, but that was klutziness. I was very graceful in the water, just not outside.
Yeah, and shoulder, people get shoulder. And I have good friends who swam competitively, shoulder injuries.
Mine's still screwed up.
But again, not brain damage.
Nope.
That's a big difference.
No.
A big difference.
That's
all right.
A future episode, right? We're doing something on CTE and equity gaps.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. It's a real issue. So, hey, we are here to talk about ed reform and especially talking about English language learners, a group that does not get the attention that they deserve in our circles. So let's do it. It's time for Ed Reform Update. All right, Connor, first of all, why is this that it seems like we have such a hard time bringing sustained attention to English language learners in our world? This seems nuts. I mean, there's a huge group of kids out there today.
I mean, there's a good reason. Part of it is that call it the No Child Left Behind Coalition, call it standards-based reform, or whatever you want to call it, the last 10, 20 years of education reform picked up the ball where they should have, which is to say that inequities in the United States education system have almost always been about race, and they've almost always been about class. So that's what we focused on. We've been talking about that forever. We've been focusing on those things forever. We've tried a lot of things around that. Now, in recent years, we've gotten to a point where about one-third of our Head Start students now are what we call dual language learners. They're speaking a non-English language at home. And it's time to also add that into these conversations. It's not that we can't talk about race and class inequities anymore, but we have to be able to talk about language too.
So what are you seeing out there, Connor, as you write about this and research this? I mean, is this just a disaster or are there some places that are doing a pretty good job, a mix? What's your take?
So the good news is, and you have to be careful a little on this, we don't have great data on a lot of what we'd like to know about how English language learners are doing. So we sometimes have to talk about children of immigrants, and sometimes we have to talk about just the broad group of Hispanic students or of Hispanic and Asian American Pacific Islander students. We just don't have the same groups. What we know is that immigrant students and children of immigrants tend to do really well over time in the United States. The sort of myth that families and students aren't integrating, aren't assimilating, aren't succeeding in the United States society is just that. It's a myth. And this is the case now with our most recent groups of immigrants. It's also been the case for the better part of 150, basically the whole story of the United States.
People sometimes make this analogy that Latinos today are akin to Italians 100 years ago. And Italians, my people, came in, pretty poor, coming from a system where they weren't getting great education back in the home country, but generation by generation have done a lot better.
Yeah, I think that's still the basic story of today.
Yep.
What we have, though, that's interesting around language specifically is that there's, within the field of American public education, there isn't nearly as strong a comprehensive expertise on how to serve these kids. We have a lot of people who have a lot of thoughts on how to serve low-income students or how to work in an urban environment. We don't have anywhere near that kind of field permeation for working on language acquisition questions. So that's one big challenge just as an inputs matter. But as far as outcomes, we have this other challenge right now, which is that we've started to establish this movement around the country in favor of something called dual immersion education.
Mm-hmm.
The best of these programs are two-way programs. They integrate. You need about the same amount approximately of native speakers of each language that you're going to be using in the classroom. So usually that's Spanish, and that means you need about half mm-hmm. your class to be native Spanish speakers mm-hmm. and then half to be English speakers. These programs teach in both languages, and because they teach content in both languages, academic content, that helps the language acquisition a lot. But most importantly, if you're in a classroom with a bunch of other kids who speak Spanish and you're an English dominant kid, you've got to learn Spanish. It becomes a sort of social proficiency that you need to have. So that works a lot better than a lot of our older models of bilingual education. This is great. So far, so good. Problem is, these programs are super popular, and they're mm-hmm. not just super popular with the ELL target audience, the folks mm-hmm. that we were originally using them to serve. We have good research showing that these two-way programs serve those kids better than any other program we can offer. We also have good evidence that in urban areas, especially here in DC, mm-hmm. people with names like Connor Williams, who speak mm-hmm. English at home, are just slavering to get into these programs. Mm-hmm. They'll do anything. So that's our problem right now, is that the integration that makes these programs work is mm-hmm. under a sort of, you don't want to say assault, but it's under a ton of pressure from gentrifiers in cities like DC, like LA and other places.
Yep. And you know, and given our patterns of housing and segregation and all the like, it is tricky. You may have a big group of, you know, affluent, mostly white, let's say, parents in one part of the metro area who really want these two-way immersion programs, but the Latino kids live 30 miles away.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is certainly the case in Montgomery County, in large mm-hmm. parts of Montgomery County, where these groups are not, you know, there's a few neighborhoods where you can point to, and there's, you know, these mm-hmm. communities are in close proximity, but is often not the case.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I live in, you mentioned it in the article you wrote recently for The Atlantic, but I live in the Oyster Adams catchment zone, and it's like, why would I ever move from the Oyster Adams catchment zone? It's just too good. But
which has a two-way bilingual program.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So so what do you think, Connor, for those people who are kind of generalists in education reform, what do you want them to know about this population? What should they be paying attention to make sure that English language learners are being well served?
They should be following some of the states that have made this and some of the locales that have made this a priority. Portland Public Schools, the fastest gentrifying, schools and school district city in the country, has done some really intentional work to try to build more dual immersion programs, but build them in such a way that they don't get gentrified quickly, that they're as mm-hmm. best as they can to kind of defend them from being overrun by English dominant privileged families. So that's one thing that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
There are states like New York State that have, in their new blueprint for success for English language learners, they've done a really outstanding job of trying to make sure that when they expand their dual immersion programs, mm-hmm. that they build those around ELLs first. We've actually written about that at New America. My colleague, Janie Carnock, wrote a great paper about this. And then most importantly, the thing that the reform community needs to think the hardest about is trying to find a way to get more bilingual teachers. And really, this wouldn't be a problem if it wasn't a zero-sum game. The problem we have right now is that we only have far under the supply we need to meet the demand for these programs in terms of bilingual teachers. So that means that every time we open one up for kids of Connor Williams, then we're having fewer and fewer kids that can serve, or fewer and fewer teachers that can serve in these two-way integrated programs.
How does this kind of challenge, what are the same in these challenges and different in these challenges when you're talking about rural bilingual kids? I think it's 1 in 5 English language learners now live in a non-urban area. And, you know, I grew up in a factory town in Iowa that was 0% Latino when I went there. And now 15 years later is 20% Latino. And I imagine the capacity challenges are very, very different, as well as many others.
No question. Logistically, it's definitely a different kind of a challenge. I mean, you got, Mike's written about this too. Urban gentrification is a problem in part because of and through density. You know, opening up a new dual immersion charter school in a town where there were only 3 schools in the first place is like a complicated solution to a problem that maybe wasn't there. And gentrifying out when you're having a hard time keeping up enrollment in the first place in your rural town is also not really an issue. The human capital side of it is also super complicated, no question.
Right.
Trying to find bilingual adults who can actually do this work is really complicated. For instance, one thing that we know is that we don't have good data on this, unsurprisingly, but it's about a fifth to a quarter of U.S. students, K-12, speak a non-English language at home. Amongst U.S. teachers, that number is closer to 1 in 8, 1 in 9.
Oh, wow.
And so what that means then is if you also then take out of that, that one, out of the 1 in 8, 1 in 9, maybe it's 1 in 10, after you take that out of that number, the ones who are like German high school teachers and a variety of sort of other, they're just not even teaching in a language, your number of teachers available to do this is really low. So the wonky stuff is like, well, what could you do? You could use Puerto Rico's teacher licensure exam in Spanish to make it easier for a Spanish-speaking adult who had all the other credentials to become certified to then teach in your state and offer instruction in Spanish. They don't really need to pass an English language test to be a Spanish-only teacher in a dual immersion program. You can monkey with visa rules if we're really dreaming, but, you know, welcome to U.S. immigration politics. It's a terrible idea.
No pun intended.
You can, yeah, right. I mean, you can do any number of other stuff like that. There's ways to grow up your multilingual paraprofessionals to be teachers in these programs.
Okay.
But there's just no simple solution, unfortunately.
But I will say, back to my Italian analogy, you know, there was certainly a long time when there were a whole lot of Italian Americans who were teaching and in schools. Mm-hmm. And, you know, teaching was often a gateway into, you know, this were college educated professions, right? That somebody who was the first in their family to get a college degree, the kind of job that they often could get was in teaching. So I guess what I'm saying is we should be able to crack this nut. That we should. We've got a lot of, especially Latino and Latina kids in high school today, that we should be able to help them, you know, get through, graduate college, and then get interested in teaching. That, you know, we should be in a better place 10 years ago. If we don't, shame on us.
Oh, no question. And this is one of the craziest things about this specific corner of ed policy is if you look, California went, you know, listeners who aren't familiar, they went English only for their English language learners for, you know, it's ever since 1998. They passed a statewide referendum. They weren't allowed to offer multilingual instruction to those kids anymore. They only just pulled that back in 2016. Meanwhile, by far the most successful state at offering multilingual instruction, and especially to English language learners, by far, it's not even close, is Texas.
Yep.
Texas has these enormous, well-run, well-funded, and well-attended institutes of higher education that produce bilingual teachers. They have whole systems that are under these transitional bilingual mandates that the state runs and the state funds. Not perfectly, no, but they fund it pretty well. And they we have something like one in six English language learners in the United States is in Texas schools. And the significant majority of those kids are in bilingual programming because the state of Texas has built this over a long period of time. Yep. Now, think about that when you think about this.
And George W. Bush was a big supporter of this.
Yeah. Well, naturally, the Bush family's famous for its bilingualism.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good, Connor.
And that served them really well in the last couple of electoral cycles, I heard.
And next time we do this, Connor, we'll do this whole thing in Spanish.
Vale. Me parece muy bien.
Hey. Can I please speak German in that conversation?
All right. Hey, that's all the time we've got. Now it's time for everyone's favorite Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
So, Amber, I was thinking of you this week. You know, Amber used to live out there in northern Montgomery County. And northern Montgomery County was responsible for my kids having a snow day with no snow and no ice.
Goodness. Tell us how you really feel, Mike.
I guess there was a patch of ice
in
out
Frederick
in
or
Poolsville or
Poolsville.
Somewhere. 20 miles from my house. And the entire system, 150,000 kids home.
Wow. Yeah. What's crazy is sometimes things that happen around Germantown and Poolsville and that area actually does not reach where you live.
No, it's exactly. Like we had some rain, I think.
Just put out there, it's a little more than some rain happening right now, but not enough to cancel
a
school.
A rain day? Really?
We had a fog day once. I'm just saying. Oh, it was great.
Oh, it's just insane, right? It's just litigious atmosphere. Are we scared of getting sued? I think that
is it.
Right.
Something like that. And look, part of the problem, you know, this is the one downside of large countywide school systems.
Yes, is that sprawling. That's right.
All right, Amber, what you got for us?
All right, we've got another huge sprawling school system. This is a study in LA Unified, the second biggest district in the country. Really cool study by Catherine Strunk, one of our EAPs. She does a lot of research in LA Unified, and she looked at whether their new teacher hiring and screening process is actually ushering in more effective teachers.
Oh, good.
Well,
so we know it's a lot harder to get rid of these poor performers after they're hired. So the idea is, hey, let's try to predict whether they're going to be effective ahead of time and hire them and get the best in the gate. The study examines the impact of the multiple measures teacher selection process. I'm just going to call it the screener because they call it the MMTSP.
Oh, good Lord.
Woo. Instituted in 2014-15, it's a standardized system of hiring. It has eight components whereby eligible candidates are scored on eight components again. Those are a structured interview, professional references, sample lesson, writing sample, undergraduate GPA, subject matter licensure score, background such as prior teaching or leadership experience, and preparation such as attendance as a highly ranked college, evidence of prior teaching effectiveness.
Ooh, all this sounds pretty comprehensive.
Eight pieces. Prior to the new process, eligibility was strongly determined through a central office interview. That was kind of like the main, thing.
And you have a heartbeat.
That also just sounds incredibly slow for a district as big as LA.
It's going to have good news. The study utilizes a wealth of applicant data, teacher and student level administrative data for the teachers who are ultimately hired, and looks at the outcomes of their students. Analysts observe those individuals who pass the selection process. It typically means you have to get an 80% score on all that stuff. And you're considered eligible. So that was about 5,000 total applications. So these are the people that had the right certification, that completed the application and got 80%. But we find out that the sample also includes 10% of applicants who were not, did not meet those at 80% because they were granted an exception. And they get an exception if the principal decides he wants a failing candidate in there anyway, for whatever reason. And there's also a number of failing applications that get reviewed again blindly by some HR staff, and they decide, well, we're going to put them back in the pool too. So they also look at those 10%.
Question for clarity. Are things like alt cert programs like Teach for America going to lead to a failure?
No, they actually get extra points if they're TFA certified. And then they basically look at, on the method side, there's this big concern that, you know, you may have sorting bias. So these teachers that maybe are already get higher screened end up going through the easier placements, for instance. So we got to figure out, like, how do we control for all that? They do a number of tests that basically say that the sorting bias is minimal. I'll just leave it at that. The results are that applicants with better performance on the screening, higher than an 80%, are more likely to be subsequently employed as teachers, even though principals don't know their exact screening score. So the ones that got even higher than an 80 were actually more likely to be employed, but they don't tell the principals, this one got a 99, you know, and this one got an 80, that kind of thing. Overall performance on the screening significantly predicts teacher outcomes once hired, including attendance, contributions to student achievement, and ratings on their performance evaluations.
Nice. That's good.
Specifically, a one standard deviation increase in overall screening score is associated both with teacher level value added that is 16% of a standard deviation higher in ELA and with as much as 73% lower odds of an unsatisfactory rating among all elementary teachers on their eval. That's big. Yet the screening performance is not predictive of teacher retention.
Well, that's not surprising because we know, you know, with retention, we tend to have our best teachers and our worst teachers, the ones that tend to leave.
That's right. Moreover, the individual components of the screening protocol are differentially predictive of different student outcomes. For example,
I'm excited. Tell us.
It's going to get worse. Applicants are more likely to be hired if they have higher interview scores. Sample lesson scores. And writing scores, among others. So those are the ones that really rose the top. Those three.
For getting hired.
Are they charismatic?
But undergraduate GPA and subject matter scores were not predictive at all.
Of getting hired,
right?
Interesting.
Finally, those who fail to meet the minimal score, those exemptions I told you about, are less likely to be employed, despite the fact that they were actively chosen by somebody to go back in the pool. The big question, can we hone the hiring protocol to pinpoint what is most important in predicting effectiveness?
Right.
But the study finds that when you start tinkering too much in an attempt to predict one particular outcome, such as value added, it reduces the ability greatly to predict pretty much everything else. So like attendance, retention, like all that stuff, it just gets really squirrely. And they talk about there are these really critical trade-offs. And if you try to go too narrow on the screener, it seems like it's just going to come back and haunt you because the whole house of cards seem to sort of fall. Which says at the end that forecasting greatness is really hard. And apparently there's a new paper coming out by Matt Kraft that was in there that talks about like how hard it is to predict teacher performance based on a very narrow band of outcomes.
Well, look, there was that great New Yorker article about how it's hard to predict who's going to be a great quarterback, NFL quarterback, and similar, you know, it's hard to predict who's going to be a great teacher. Right.
What's
his name? The Outliers guy.
Oh, Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah. So that's still, I mean, Foles, right? Was not even.
We were just talking about that. He wasn't even going to be a quarterback.
Exactly. Yeah. Tied in there. Anyway. So, you know, it is a little troubling, isn't it, that these school systems don't seem to, that at least LA doesn't seem to care. Well, let's put this way. The principals don't seem to care about undergraduate GPA or some of these test scores. I mean, it's what we've always suspected, is that maybe, you know, school systems have a anti-intellectual bias per se. Mm-hmm. Then again, I can understand that you want to see if somebody's good at teaching the lesson.
Or alternate hypothesis for the grade inflation guy. Maybe all of the grades are, you know, between, maybe all of the GPAs are so close that they're inflated. Thinking that they're not super predictive if it's a 3.2 versus 3.4. I really looked at
writing, right? Writing was one that popped. Okay. And writing, by the way, is tied to verbal ability, which we know that verbal ability is tied to effectiveness. Right. So it's a little circular.
Okay. All right. But look, this sounds like an excellent screener. And so now the question is, what has to happen for every school system in the country to use something like this, right? I mean, you know, it kills me that there are still places out there that are, like you said, doing cronyism or just, you know, we're going to have an interview with the central office. All right. And that's, you know, or the, you know, stories from after Hurricane Maria, where these Puerto Rican teachers are showing up in Florida and getting hired in the airport. and people saw it as kind of a heartfelt, isn't this great that, you know, which I get, but also like, really? That's our screen? You're from Puerto Rico. And you're here, and we're going to hire you.
We need you, yes. Ooh, well, I know. It's good stuff. You know, hey, we've been trying around here at Fordham, right, to do like little homework tests before we hire anybody. Mm-hmm. So we don't just do an interview. Although,
no.
I mean, the interview is important, though, I got to say. But the homework is too.
There's good research in all areas, all sectors, that interviews can be highly misleading. Oh, one last question. Anything about teacher diversity? Did they look at that?
Not see that at all.
Okay, I'll be curious how that pans out.
Yet.
Okay, and hey, Amber, you got a highly effective for tying in the Super Bowl.
Thank you.
All right. Hey, that is all the time we got for this week. Till next week.
I'm Alyssa Schwenk.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.